Chapter 27. I headed for the Big Hood's hideout with several important facts in mind. Fact 1, the Big Hoods themselves could not do me harm. Fact 2, there wasn't diddly I could do to the Big Hoods. Fact 3, the Big Hoods were apparently led by this gray ghost, a spirit that had been tossing lightning around with impunity during the attack on Morty's house. That meant that the gray ghost was the shade of someone with at least a sorcerer's level of talent, and while I felt sure I could defend myself against such an assault if I was ready for it, if I got blindsided, I might end up like Sir Stuart quicker than you could say Kazat. Fact 4, the gray ghost had a bunch of lemurs hanging around. While my own spectral evocations might not be able to affect the living, they would sure as hell work on lemurs and the like. I could handle them easily, one-on-one, but it seemed likely that they would come at me in waves, or maybe try to wear me down by throwing a horde of wraiths at me first. Fact 5, if the gray ghost was giving the orders to mortal cultists, they might have taken measures of their own to deal with ghosts. There might be circle traps prepared. There might be wards or other magical barriers. There might be dangerous substances like ghost dust. If I went in all fat and happy and confident, I could wander right into serious trouble. Fact 6, there were all kinds of spiritual beings in the wide universe, and ghosts were only a tiny cross-section of them. I had to be ready for anything. Another entity of some sort might well wander in, drawn by the conflict. Or hell, for all I knew, one might already be taking a hand. No closed minds, Dresden, I ordered myself. Don't get suckered into thinking this is one limited, small-scale problem. There's every chance it might be part of a much, much larger problem. If my afterlife went anything like my life had, that seemed a safe bet. Fact 7. Sooner or later, damn it, I was going to start laying out a little chastisement where it was long overdue. I flashed back to several vivid memories of when I had done exactly that. Images of violence and flame and hideous foes flickered through my head, sharp and nearly real. The emotions that accompanied those memories came along for the ride, but they were one step removed, distant enough to let me process them, identify them. Rage, of course. Rage at the creatures who were trying to harm the innocent or my friends or me. That rage had been both a weapon and armor to me in moments of mortal peril. It was always there, and I always welcomed its arrival. Being filled with anger was infinitely preferable to being filled with terror. But seeing it in my heightened memories, it made me feel a little sick. Rage was a word we used for anger when it was being used in the cause of right, but that didn't sanctify it or make it somehow laudable. It was still anger. Violent, dangerous anger, as deadly as a flying bullet. It just happened to be a bullet that was aimed in a convenient direction. Fear, next. Always fear. It doesn't matter how personally courageous you are. When something is trying to kill you and you know it, you're afraid. It's a mindless, lizard-brain emotion. There's no way to stop it. Courage is about learning how to function despite the fear, to put aside your instincts to run or give in completely to the anger born from fear. Courage is about using your brain and your heart when every cell of your body is screaming at you to fight or flee, and then following through on what you believe is the right thing to do. The White Council blamed me for causing trouble with various supernatural evils. And while I'm not quite arrogant enough to blame all the world's problems on my mistakes, they probably had a point. I have issues with bullies and authority figures, and I refuse to stand by and do nothing when those too weak to defend themselves become victims. But how much of that had been courage, and how much of it had been me embracing my probably righteous anger so that I wouldn't feel the fear? As the memories flipped by, I saw myself again and again throwing myself into the fire, sometimes literally, to help someone who needed it or to kill something that needed killing. The tidal surges of my emotion had propelled me, fueled my magic, and many times they had made it possible to survive when I wouldn't have otherwise. But when I'd been running on adrenaline, I'd rarely stopped to consider the extended consequences of my actions. By saving Susan from Bianca of the Red Court, I had offered a high-profile insult to the entire vampire nation. When Duke Ortega had shown up to challenge me to a duel to restore the honor of the Red Court and forestall a war, it had ended in a bloodbath, and it had never occurred to me to attempt to ensure any other outcome. As a result of the disastrous duel, a wizard named Ebenezer McCoy, my grandfather, had brought an old Soviet satellite down from its orbit right on top of Ortega's stronghold. No one survived. Then Ariana, Ortega's wife, the daughter of the Red King, had sought her own vengeance even as the Red Court launched a full-scale war. Ariana's vengeance had materialized in the form of murdering my daughter's foster family and abducting her. Once Susan heard about it, she got in touch, and again I flung myself into fire without a thought. None of those things had to happen. I mean, I wasn't the only guy in the world who had driven that course of events, I knew that. But I had been the guy who had been standing at the tipping point between possible outcomes with depressing regularity. Could I have done something differently? Was it even possible to know? In my memories, I murdered Susan Rodriguez again. Time heals all wounds, they say, but I somehow knew I wouldn't be able to escape this one. Granted, only a few days' subjective time had passed since the events of that evening, so the memory was still fresh in my painfully clear recollection. But time wasn't going to help much with what I'd done, and it probably shouldn't. I wanted to hurt the Gray Ghost and its merry band of shades. I wanted to hurt them badly, make them feel the vitriol burning inside my belly. I wanted to take them on and smash them to flinders upon my will. But maybe I should pause for a moment. Maybe I should think. Maybe I should reject both anger and fear and strive for an outcome beyond kicking down the door and smashing everything in my way. Play it smart. Play it responsible. A little late for you to be learning that lesson now, isn't it, dummy? I asked. No. It was never too late to learn something. The past is unalterable in any event. The future is the only thing we can change. Learning the lessons of the past is the only way to shape the present and the future. Why did I want this fight so badly? Here's a thought, genius, I said to me. Maybe it's got something to do with Maggie. Maggie, my little girl. I would never see her grow up. I would never get to watch for any signs of manifesting talent so that I could teach her and give her the choice of how to live her life. I would never get to hear her sing a song or go trick-or-treating or send her a present for Christmas. I would never... At some point during that dark thunderstorm of regret, fire had erupted from seemingly every surface of my body, a furious red-gold flame. It wasn't hot at first, but after a few seconds it got uncomfortable and rapidly progressed to actual pain. I ground my teeth, closed my eyes, and forced order upon my thoughts, tried to replace the outrage with cool, steady logic. Several seconds later, the fire died away. I opened my eyes slowly, eyeing the scorch marks on my coat and a blister or two on my exposed skin. Clear bubbles of ectoplasm dribbled from the blisters. "So, yeah," I said. "You may have anger issues where Maggie is concerned, Harry." "You think?" "Got a rocket," I sang, "in your pocket. Turn off the juice, boy." "Show tunes? Really? It wasn't bad enough that you started talking to yourself, man. Now you're doing performing art." But the musically inclined me had a point. "Play it cool, boy," I whispered. "Real cool." I approached the Big Hood's lair obliquely and cautiously. One might even accuse me of being overly cautious. I circled the lair from all angles, including up above, in a slow spiral-shaped pattern that only gradually drew closer. I held a veil over myself the entire time, too. It wasn't any easier as a ghost than it had been in the flesh, and I still couldn't throw the greatest veil in the world, but I managed to make myself, if not invisible, at least difficult to see. I wasn't there to fight. I was there to learn. Mort needed my help, but maybe the best way to give it to him wasn't to go charging in like a rogue rhinoceros. Knowledge is power. I needed all the power I could get if I was going to help Morty. The problem was that the gray ghost had apparently marshaled supporters of both the spirit and the flesh, and I couldn't fight the damned crazy thugs who just happened to be made of solid matter. I'd need help. Maybe I could hop into Morty again and toss out enough power to let him run away, but that assumed Morty would let me step in at all. He sure as hell didn't seem to like it the first time. It also assumed that he would be free and able to physically escape, and that I could neutralize his material captors. There was no guarantee either of those things would be the case. I thought that the tip from Nick was a good one. I think he had identified the right bunch of yahoos, and I had faith in his knowledge of Chicago streets. After a lifetime walking them and surviving, Nick was an expert. Chicago PD's gang unit sometimes went to him for advice. Sometimes he even gave it to them. But any expert could be wrong. If the gray ghost was wily enough to have a hideout separate from its material mook's living quarters and had stashed Mort there, I was about to waste a whole lot of time. But how would it get a setup of its own without physical help to establish it? If it was strong enough, I suppose, it could have a demesne of its own in the never-never, the spirit world. I dealt with a ghost named Agatha Hagglethorne once, and she'd had her own little pocket dimension filled with a Victorian-era copy of Chicago. It burned down. I was not responsible. Anyway, I had to wonder if the gray ghost didn't have a similar resource. It would make one fine hidey hole to avoid annoying things like sunrise, daylight, and recently deceased wizards. I paused for a moment to consider a notion. I wondered if I could establish a demesne of my own. I mean, theoretically, I knew how it would work. Granted, there's as much space between theory and practice in magic as there is in physics, but it isn't an unbridgeable gap. I was reasonably sure it could be done. Maybe I could get Butters to let me talk shop with Bob for a few minutes. He'd know what I needed to make it happen, I was sure. But what would I make it look like? I mean, in theory, I could make it practically anything I wanted. I'm sure there would be some kind of energy-to-area requirement that would limit it in absolute terms, but if I wanted, I could make it look like the Taj Mahal or the old Aladdin's Arcade where I used to play video games back before my magic made it all but impossible. I could have a mansion. I could probably make some kind of simulacrum of a butler if I wanted. I sighed. Bob would, I was certain, suggest simulacrum French maids tottering around in stiletto heels as his first and most conservative contribution. It would only get more depraved from there. In the end, there was really only one of a couple of things my demesne could possibly be, a Burger King restaurant or my old apartment, the one that had burned with the rest of my life. Suddenly, there was no appeal in considering my own demesne anymore. Stop wasting time, I told myself. I shook off the thoughts and continued my stalk of the Big Hood's clubhouse, sniffing around for possible magical defenses. Alarm spells seemed most likely, but I had to assume that a ghostly sorcerer could create as much destructive mayhem as a mortal one. I could run into anything from ill-tempered guardian entities to a magical equivalent of Claymore anti-personnel mines. Hell, I'd seen a vampire's nest that used actual AP mines. Nasty toys. I would be keeping an eye out for any physical defenses as well, in the event I needed to warn Murphy or her crew about them when I showed up for the actual rescue operation. For the op, I corrected myself. Sounds cooler if you call it the op. I moved closer, veil in place, senses tuned to the possibility of danger. Definitely. Murphy would call it the op. The entrance to the hideout was just where Nick had said it would be, beneath an overpass where a steel door had once led to an old City Works storage area. I found no suspect magic in the immediate area around the bridge, which made sense. If I had been spreading detection spells around my own hideout, I wouldn't have gone to the trouble to set them up where the sunrise would obliterate them every morning. To make something that lasted longer than a day or two at most, considerable effort was required. At the very least, you'd have to use some kind of physical object to harbor the spell's energy. Technically, you could use any object, though it was not unheard of for wizards to utilize whatever they happened to have in their pockets at the time. It's probably where all the old stories of enchanted spindles, combs, brushes, and mirrors come from. Most often, the magical energy was channeled into carvings or painted symbols. I'd once set up a rental storage unit as a short-term haven in case things ever went to hell. I'd laid up about 100 small protective spells on the walls, floor, and ceiling of the place in various colors of paint. The energy inside them was stored in the paint, safe from the sunrise and ready to project a shield whenever the symbols felt the touch of hostile magic. But a monitoring spell wouldn't be the kind of thing that could lie dormant. It had to actually be looking around all the time. That meant a constant, modest expenditure of energy, which would in turn be exposed and vulnerable to sunrise. Landmine-type spells were a lot easier, like my protective spells, only with more kaboom in them. I wasn't surprised that I didn't find any of those outside the hideout. Few people would host a picnic underneath the overpass, but it was Chicago, and all sorts of folks would be through this area during the day. Random people being horribly incinerated would certainly draw the attention of the local authorities, and possibly that of the White Council. The Gray Ghost didn't seem to be an idiot. No death traps were left lying around where some school kid or bum might stumble into them. I wouldn't have set up like that either. It made far more sense for such sentry spells to be laid down underground, deep enough for the steady presence of the earth to shield the spelled energy from disruption. The Gray Ghost was smart. Things would get interesting about 15 or 20 feet down. I finished my last circuit of the site and moved to the door. I reached out a hand and stopped with my palm about an inch away from the metal. I sensed something subtle, but there, like an attractive field around the old weak magnet. I frowned and focused on it, finding a spell of composition unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It was something subliminal, sending out a kind of beckoning energy that I wouldn't have noticed had I not been specifically looking for something like it. It would otherwise have been buried in the background energy of the city and its inhabitants. I stretched out a hand to touch this stream of energy flowing steadily outward. It oozed over the surface of my skin, a crawling sensation that made me shudder. It's smarter not to play around with unfamiliar magic. Besides, I had other things to do. I lowered my hand and stepped toward the source of the music I'd begun hearing in my head at some point. There was little sense wasting more time up on the surface, and I hadn't heard that song in forever, but I could still sing along. I started humming and stopped myself with my nose about half an inch from the steel door. I broke out into a cold sweat. Hell's bells. That magic hadn't been heavy duty, but it had been puissant. A few seconds after touching it, I had almost walked blindly and mindlessly through the door and into whatever reception was prepared for intruders on the other side. I couldn't know exactly what was over there without getting a look, but it sure as hell wasn't a gift basket and a bottle of wine. I stepped back from the door and the siren spell with what I felt was a properly Darwinian appreciation of the danger it represented. Oh, it might not blow you up like the defensive wards I'd had on my apartment, but a scalpel can open up your arteries just as readily as a sword. In some cases, more so. I shivered and clutched my arms to my belly. That spell wasn't the work of a novice or marauding sorcerer experimenting with magic he'd found in the metaphysical section of a bookstore. Whoever had put that thing together had been a true professional, one with centuries of experience. One who was probably more capable than I when it came to magic. Don't get me wrong, I'm Hoss. When the spells start flying, mine are some of the flashiest, most violent on the planet. I'm like the Andre the Giant of the supernatural world. I've got a lot of power and mass to throw around. Andre would be a great person to have on your side in a brawl against a rowdy tavern crowd, but in a more focused situation, he would be at the mercy of professionals who, while lacking his raw power, could nonetheless apply their own strength more efficiently and effectively. Murphy was an excellent example of that kind of fighter. She wasn't much bigger than a bread box, but I'd seen her toss around guys weighing most of 300 pounds like they were unruly puppies. If the Grey Ghost was responsible for that spell, then I was lucky to have survived our first meeting. The smart move would be to scamper. If it came to a fair fight, I might find myself completely outclassed. I felt a shivering, cold presence on the back of my neck and turned to find wraiths nearby. They drifted toward the hideout from all directions, coming in a slow, steady procession and moving in perfectly straight lines. The siren spell made sense to me now. It wasn't a guard spell, though it could certainly have that purpose. It was also a beacon, a dinner bell being rung to signal the mindless horde now approaching. They never sped up, never slowed. They just kept floating forward until they began to pass through the closed steel door in groups of 2 and 3 as they converged upon it. I pursed my lips, thinking. The Grey Ghost wasn't killing wraiths. It was using them. For the moment, at least, there wouldn't be any kind of guard spell on the other side of the door. There couldn't be, or the Grey Ghost would be slaughtering its own troops and wasting its own investment of time and energy to boot. I might have an opportunity here. The inbound wraiths would almost certainly be routed by what amounted to a cattle chute. That route would most likely be clear of supernatural booby traps. It might be possible to gain entry, find a vulnerable point along the chute, and then duck out of it to run a quick reconnaissance of the Grey Ghost's headquarters and find Mort. It took half an hour for the procession to be complete, and the flow of wraith traffic never let up. I stopped counting them at 450 and swallowed. That wasn't a herd of wraiths. That was a bloody horde. If one of the wraiths decided it wanted to eat me, it would have to perform a miracle to divide me into enough pieces to feed all of its dinner company. My veil seemed to have prevented me from being noticed as they approached, but that could just as easily be the effect of the beacon spell. For all I knew, once the beacon shut off, they'd all turn around and come at me like greyhounds leaving the gate. It would require a singularly stupid man to go hang around in narrow tunnels and cramped spaces alongside a threat like that. And I, Harry Dresden, am that man, I stated. I waited for the last wraith to go in and counted to 20. My mouth felt dry. Fear boiled in my belly and made my knees feel unsteady. My fingers trembled. I told them all that they were just preconceived residual memories anyway, and that I would tolerate no guff from them. Then I ground my teeth and followed the horde.